United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit is now in session.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We understand that everyone is ready who intends to present argument, and so we will proceed to hear the cases for argument in the order that they are listed. The first case, Stedham v. the State of California, is submitted on the briefs, and so the first case for argument is Kessler v. Milligan. Ms. Cartledge.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Lynn Cartledge.
Are you arguing that sort of as a per se matter, not having access to library or law materials suffices to toll? Well, that does differ from Whalen Hunt, because no matter what that case said, it was a situation in which there were materials in the law library which could have been misleading because they didn't include the new AEDPA statute with a statute of limitations. So it was a misleading kind of situation. But here, there's nothing to mislead, is there?
Well, basically,
you're saying that there has to be a complete, accurate law library. That's a different issue. That's the ineffective assistance issue.
Right. Well, it is part of the different issue, but had he known that that was the case, had he known that fact, that that was the case, then he would have been able to, when he called her during that 30-day jurisdiction period of time, he would have been able to say, file an appeal. The trial court used its discretion and did not give a due process. I made a new trial. And I think it would have been successful.
But even though he lacked the materials, he didn't file a writ in the state court. So doesn't that preclude a finding that this was an impediment under the statute?
I don't think so, Judge Nelson. I think what it is that I'll go back to the fact that he did not find out the factual basis, and I understand that from subsection B rather than subsection B, which I think was an impediment as well.
Was it a factual basis or was it a legal basis?
This is where I think the district court erred. The district court found it was a legal basis, but I think it was actually his knowledge of that the statute was wrong. Did he know that what she had done was wrong? He didn't know that. I don't think that's a legal question. I think it's the content of the statute that we need to go. I understand it's a fine question. Maybe it's a mixed question. But I don't think it's a legal question.
Wait, something just blew by me. What is the relief that you think that you're entitled to?
What we would like is for it to go back to the district court. We remain back in the district court. We actually would like kind of what we argue in one of our footnotes in the blue brief, and that is the same sort of result that we got in that case. We'd like it to go back to the district court with a conditional writ to be granted or he would be released if they could show that Kessler did not consent to be appealed.
I have a question. Let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that we agree with you that Lund's misconduct was egregious and that equitable tolling might apply. When would such tolling have begun and when would such tolling have ended?
Okay. He, of course, gets tolling from the time of the year 2000 through 2002, which is the time that he did file a bankruptcy. So that would be tolled. The equitable tolling then would have to apply to the time that he was convicted in 1995 up until 2000. I think we filed the state post-conviction petition right before the five-year presumption attaches in the state court. What I'd really like this court to understand is what we argued for the district court, and perhaps the way I argued it, I'm not saying that the district court was erroneous on its own behalf, maybe it was my fault, but what I needed the court to understand was we are arguing that her IAC, in other words, her telling him not to appeal, was what we were arguing about as the statute stands. And that because she...
But he knowingly pled guilty.
Correct.
Voluntarily to a plea where it was indicated that there were consecutive sentences.
I disagree with that.
Okay, what's wrong with that?
He pled guilty and asked the sentencing. His attorney brought him aside, and I know exactly what has happened, but I've been in that sort of thing now, and said to him, and this is all in the pleading, said to him, this cannot be concurrent. These must be consecutive. I'm crossing out initially with Dorian, and within 5 minutes he was in there and he pled guilty. She misled the court. She misled the...
The court said, shouldn't this be concurrent, and she said no. Indeed, the prosecutor and the court thought it would be concurrent, and she said no, they have to be consecutive.
That's correct. The prosecutor didn't say that because the prosecutor had written a plea agreement that said it.
Right. Well, I'm indicated that the prosecutor and the court both thought that it should be concurrent.
Right. It seems to me that all the court had to do was go back and ask his law firm to look it up and
okay, so the mistake of counsel was that counsel thought that it would have to be consecutive.
And the mistake of counsel, which when he called for it during that 30-day period.
Okay, now, that was a mistake of law because actually the court did have authority to consider?
That's correct.
Okay.
And I'd like to...
How much time went by before the petition was filed?
It was less than 5 years, but just a little bit less than 5 years. And the reason we're saying that is because the way Stewart Correctional Camp is set up, he's not allowed to talk to other prisoners. He didn't know anything about this. The attorney had told him he couldn't appeal. He did not run into Mayfield until approximately 7 months before he filed his post-conviction petition. And Nevada does not allow him at that time to file a direct appeal.
Okay, thank you.
Police Court Counsel, my name is Robert Whelan. I'm the Senior Deputy Attorney General, but I also the Attorney General of the State of Nevada. I have the privilege to represent the respondents in this particular matter. First point I'd like to take issue with is counsel's statement with respect to the uncontroverted facts in this particular matter. The State has never acceded or conceded to any of the representations or the factual representations made by the petitioner of the counsel during the course of this litigation.
Don't we have to assume, though, that, or do we? For purposes of this appeal, don't we have to assume that we are?
For purposes of this appeal, I think what the federal district judge is saying that as a matter of law,
right.
If this were the case, Mr. Kessler is not entitled to either equitable or statutory tolling. Mr. Kessler was convicted in December of 1995. Of course, the EDPA became effective on April 24th, 1996.
Counsel, I hate to interrupt you, but since we have such a short period of time, let me tell you what really worries me about this case. The cases you cited in your brief about negligence of attorneys seem to me to be distinguishable from this case, where we have an attorney's misrepresentation during a plea agreement and a plea hearing, and crossing it out, then telling the judge, no, it's consecutive. Isn't this far different from just saying a mistake of law? It's affirmative action here against her client.
May I?
Yes, of course.
Just so that I can make sure that we're on the same page.
All right.
Are you suggesting that this is egregious conduct by a counsel such that it would warrant actual holding?
Yes.
Okay. The difference between this case, and I must direct this court's attention to the recent case, Stinson v. Moore. I apologize, that's not cited in my brief. But the difference between that case and this case is that in the Stinson case, the counsel was retained, and there was a direct relationship between the intention of counsel and counsel's duties and the filing of the federal habeas corpus petition. In those cases in which this court and other courts have addressed the egregious conduct of counsel, the relationship between counsel and the filing of the federal habeas petition has been direct. As in Stinson, counsel was specifically retained to file the federal habeas petition. In this particular case, we are talking about trial counsel who had nothing whatsoever. There isn't any nexus between that, any direct nexus between that and the filing of the federal habeas petition.
I'm sorry, I don't see the distinction. The counsel was hired to represent the defendant and affirmative. I mean, this was not simply she failed to do something. She acted in an affirmative way to cross out a line in the plea agreement and then misled the court. Well, let's leave that for a moment. And assuming that this is egregious misconduct, when would the tolling begin and end, in your opinion?
Reserving my disagreement.
Indeed. I understand.
If it were egregious misconduct, as under this, it would still, now we have to ask whether or not the petitioner knew or could have done of the error.
That's true, even if it's egregious?
Yes.
Okay.
You don't just all of a sudden say because it's egregious misconduct, you get that.
Forever. Yeah. That's why I asked the question. Just what do you get?
You would get the opportunity, perhaps, if it hasn't already taken, to show the state would have the opportunity to show the facts that this individual, either you or by due diligence, could have done of the error. I think we already know the answer to that. As I said, the state does not accept the representation that this individual is about the law library or about resources of any kind or nature whatsoever. Indeed, if you look at the petitioner's opening brief in this particular case, he points to the Allen v. State 1982 case upon which he relies for the argument that that is the basis of the legal error that his trial has to make.
Now, the question is when he would start looking, because the judge has already agreed with his own attorney, who says it is consecutive.
That being the case, he still has constructive knowledge of the law.
Even though the judge and the attorney do not.
Well,
presumptively.
Okay. He has knowledge of a variety of things in this particular case. First of all, he knows that the agreement, as was initially presented to him, had a statement that the sentences could be consecutive or concurrent.
And that should have put his attorney on notice, by the way, should it not?
Yes.
And then when the judge said, well...
We're not arguing that the counsel did not misadvise Mr. Chet. But the misadvice, insofar as the client's concerned, is immaterial to the question. And the question is whether or not there are extraordinary circumstances in the his control made it impossible for him to timely file a federal habeas petition, or under 2244D1D, the factual predicate question. Those are the two issues here. And it's our position that that's actually the relevant to this, to the resolution of the issue. Because, as Judge Reed said, it wasn't that mistake. It was still sitting on his hands during all of those 5 years before he took any action whatsoever. An individual was presumed to know the law. There are hosts of cases that say that even federal habeas actions against the law is
is the law that if he had asked for legal materials at any time during that 5 years that he had, would have, if he had asked for legal materials at any time during that 5 years, would he have received them?
If he had asked?
Uh-huh.
We don't know whether he did or
not. No. I'm just saying, what is the law here? If a prisoner wants access to legal materials, does the state have to provide them? What does Bounds say about that?
One of the reasons why I disagree with the petitioner's factual assertions is I do believe the Historic Conservation Department has a law.
We have to assume that they don't, but
okay.
I'm just asking you about the law. I thought there was certain right to access to the courts, and I had...
There is an access to the courts, but the nature and extent of the, exactly what you have to have in your law library at any particular institution, I don't know that there is any case that says...
I'm trying to help you out here. If he had...
I'm trying to give you an answer.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Bounds says, first of all, that you have to have a law library or a minimum law library. I think Bounds says nothing more than you have to give them access to the courts, which means you can't take all written materials away from them. You can't...
Okay, so in other words, if he had said, I want to check it out and see whether my sentence could have been concurrent, let me see the statutes, that they wouldn't have to give them to him.
I don't know what they would have.
Okay. Let me ask you one more question. Was there any allegation here that the conduct of the attorney was deliberate? That is, that he deliberately, knowingly misled the court?
Except for the fact that the prosecutor put it in the plea agreement. She scratched it out without even considering whether or not she was right. Then the judge said, well, I thought it was concurrent. And she says, no, it's consecutive.
No, I am very confident that Ms. Munton, when she made that, believed that she was correct. I believe that she was correct.
Shouldn't she have been put on notice, though, when both of them raised that issue? Wouldn't any reasonable person wonder whether or not she was correct?
I don't know what research she did. Maybe she
they made a deal. There was a deal, wasn't there?
That's correct.
Okay. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
What do you do about Spitzen?
I don't know the case, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I don't think the side of the reason I'm not aware of it. I have to listen to something that
it might have helped you.
I do want to reassess for the court what relief we're trying to get. And that is, I'd like the court to remand back to this report with instructions. And I think one of the things that might make this case a little different from the others is that since at the time of the trial, the vast majority of the Harris v. Warden has found that finding prejudice is not established for the petitioner under exactly the same circumstances here. So if it were to be sent back to the district court with a conditional writ and tell the state to release him or allow him to get an appeal, he could not have a direct appeal at this point. Because the vast Supreme Court has already said in his obvious state, you can't get it, it's jurisdictional, you're outside of 30 days. He also cannot have...
Nobody's ever reached the merits of the habeas. I just don't get the concept of us issuing some kind of conditional writ. The only issue up here is statutory or equitable tolling in order to allow someone, the district court or anybody else, to consider the merits of the habeas petition.
Well, we raised over and over that he was not allowed to file his direct appeal.
Well, I understand that, but that's a merits issue. You've got to get over the bar of it being untimely before the merits are reached.
Well, I think Wade on Hunt covers that. I think
yeah,
that
okay.
is that his attorney told him not to appeal the very thing that would have, I think, given him the relief in that. Those are the things that I think establishes the equitable tolling, subsection B and subsection B. And if the court's wondering why I was concerned about these cases, in Nevada, it depends on the judge you get and the attorney you hire. What you get in the DUI case. The cases are all over the map.
That's true.
A year up to 20 years, and this is a good man, and it's a sad thing that it happened to all.
Thank you. The case just argued is submitted for decision. We'll hear the next case, Sanchez Livia versus Ayers.
The 1972 Nevada State Court decision at issue involved a decision that was contrary to an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. Under the circumstances, that decision was objectively reasonable. The judge's labor filed a petition after 1996.